This is Kathy Valentine. I'm from the Go-Go's, and you're listening to Holly and Dave on the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
Oh, yeah, you're in a good mood because we're still talking with Kathy Valentine of the Go-Go's.
Yes, we are back with Kathy Valentine on the What Difference Does It Make podcast. Welcome to part two of our talk with Kathy Valentine of the Go-Go's.
Did you play all the instruments on that on your soundtrack for the book? Is that all you?
Yeah, I had a blast. I wrote it all. I sang it all. I performed everything. I had a co-producer in New York, a great composer that was mixing for me, and co-producing in that, you know, helping keep me on track and bouncing ideas off of. Yeah, but I compiled everything and recorded everything in my home, and had a great time. I mean, I was making beats. I had all these influences that I'd never, you know, when you're in a band. I mean, I knew when I made my first solo album I never wanted to be a star. I never wanted to be a solo artist, but it gave me a lot of confidence in my abilities as a producer and as a musician. I'm like, oh, you're good. You know, and I really believed it because when you're in a band, a lot of your ideas, somebody will go, oh, no, I don't like that. And you can make it go, oh, maybe I'm not as good as I think I am. Or, you know, oh, I don't like that song. But when you're doing it by yourself, for better or for worse, there's no one saying that's not good. You decide what's good enough. And you might write a whole song or record a whole song, and then you decide it's not good enough. But no one's shooting down anything. And it was really good for my confidence the first time I did it. And doing this record, I was like, holy cow. I mean, I knew I was a good bass player in the Go-Go's. I knew I did a great job of that. But I would have never thought of myself as, you know, somebody that could go play bass. I wasn't Gail Ann Dorsey, you know, I wasn't Tal Wilkenfeld on the, I knew that. But on this soundtrack, I was like, man, I played some really great bass. I played some great guitar. And I knew I was a good guitar player. I was proud of it. I still am really proud of it. And plus, artistically, it's just super innovative because I really capture the tone and the feel of the chapter. Like when I write a song to go with Camouflage, which is a chapter about a home invasion robbery where me and my two friends could have easily ended up murdered. And you have to read the book to read the story.
Yes.
But it's really scary. And when I wrote the soundtrack to that chapter, I wanted to bring into the music the tension and the fear and how lost I was after that had happened, because that came right on the heels of the band breaking up. And I'm in this house on the Hollywood Hills. I don't know how I'm going to pay for it. The Go-Go's have broken up. I'm completely lost, completely devastated. And now I don't feel safe in my home. The home I don't even know how I'm going to pay for. I don't feel safe. And so it was very lost. And I really loved expressing these things.
Hollywood Hills, August 1985. All nighter high heat. He's behind her, and there's something bad about to happen. There's something bad about to happen. How did he get to the top of Sunset Plaza? How did he know? Do as you're told.
Wild eyed and sweat shouting orders.
All of you, get in here right now.
Face down on the shelf.
Years are rushing.
Time is still.
I can't think straight.
Do something.
Move.
Obey.
Fight.
Now I must secure you.
Please don't hurt us.
Now I must camouflage you.
Camouflage? Why?
Immobilize, terrorize. Now he's out to butcher knives.
I will not be easy to kill.
I think we're gonna die on this hill.
And it's not all a downer. There's a chapter about getting raped. Oh, that's not a downer. No, that's a there's a chapter about being raped at 14. And that music is beautiful. It makes me cry. It makes people that listen to it cry. But then there's other stuff that's just rocking and fun and like just full of attitude. So I'm super proud of it. And I highly encourage people to listen to the soundtrack. If I had my choice, I would say listen to it after the book. But it stands on its own. And the audiobook comes with the complete soundtrack along with underscoring that's not the soundtrack, that just goes with what I'm narrating. And it's super cool. I've gotten a lot of feedback from the audiobook where people are just blown away. It's almost like podcast because it's so integrated.
It's a sordid affair. Begin in a blackout. The clouds parted, the sun found me in those vanished hours. Still in the game, I'm a tearaway ricochet. Wake up the dreamland, do it the right way. Yeah, I'm in the game, I still got a shot. Gonna go from the bottom all the way to the top.
I thought that was such a great idea. I loved listening to it while I was reading.
Thank you.
Is that in your future now? I know there's a great filmmaking scene in Austin. Is doing soundtracks something that is on your radar?
I would give anything a shot. You know, I'm trying to make a living. So, yeah, I would give anything a shot. It's just it's a challenge. Anything challenging and new. I was offered a part in a film in 2015, and I was like, no, I don't want to do that. And they were like, no, I wrote this part with you in mind. I'm like, what? And I was terrified. And it ended up being one of my favorite things I've ever done. The film, I don't even know if it ever got distribution, but I loved it. And I was asked to be a keynote speaker, and I was terrified because it's one thing to get in front of people and just have your guitar and be singing and rocking out. But it's another thing to stand in front of them and just be you. And, you know, sometimes people just don't like you. They just like, they're just like, I don't like her. They don't know why. And when you stand in front of a room full of people and talk, that can happen. So I was terrified of that. I want to be liked. But it was exhilarating. What I found was that I connected with people, which is what it's all about. So I would love the opportunity to do anything, really. I would be a DJ. I just like trying things out and doing them. And, you know, I'm not going to do well at everything, but I've come to a place in my life where I don't have to be great. For a long time, it's like, I'm not going to do that unless I'm great at it. And I think that even kept me from writing a book for a long time, you know, because I didn't want to write a lame book. I didn't want to write. And I was afraid, and I didn't read a lot of memoirs. I read classic literature, and that's intimidating. You're like, oh, I'll never be, you know, Flannery O'Connor. I'll never be, you know, whatever, Thomas Mann. And yet when I started reading memoirs, I was like, well, I have a story to tell, and, you know, I don't have to be the literary brilliant genius of the 21st century to write a memoir. I have to be honest and a little bit literary and a little bit lyrical, like I can do, and maybe I can do a good job of this. So
I think you nailed it.
I do too, to be honest. I think
good.
That's fine, because what you were talking about, it made me think of, you had the opportunity, or it never came to fruition, where you were going to audition for Light of Day, did go to Joan Jett. But then afterward, you said, oh, I didn't want to act anyway. So it seemed like at that time, you're trying to convince yourself, this is something I didn't want to do. But maybe deep down, it was something that, you know, you wanted to try.
Once I had the opportunity, I was like, yeah, I wanted to do it. But when I didn't get it, you know, I'm, you know, above and beyond anything, I'm a self-preservationist. And I've felt from the time I was a child, my job is to take care of myself. No one else is going to do it. That's my job. So taking care of myself means not wallowing in a defeat. That's what I'm going to do. And if I didn't get the gig, you know, I'm not going to give up, but I'm going to spin it. I'm going to spin it where I can move forward. And at that time, the spin was, I don't want to act anyway. I want to be in a band. So it doesn't mean I didn't want to, but it meant that was my device for taking care of myself and moving forward. You know, I've had a lot of people say, you have had so much betrayal and so much abandonment, and yet you seem so open and forgiving. And they're kind of like waiting for this, like, spiritual, you know, and I'm like, yeah, because that's what's best for me. It's, you know, it doesn't serve me to hold grudges, to be full of resentment, to be bitter. That doesn't help me move forward. That doesn't help me grow. So as much as I would like to say I'm a saint who is just overbrimming with forgiveness and whatnot, it's really about how can I grow? How can I move forward? How can I do what's best for me? Being good to people is what's best for me. Caring about other people is what's best for me. When I was younger, I was a little bit more limited in doing what was best for me, like taking care of myself, paying the bills, playing my parts well, making sure I was showing up. And, you know, that was all best for me. Or as I've gotten older, a lot of what's best for me, besides taking care of myself physically, is taking care of myself spiritually. And the way I can do that is with love and compassion and forgiveness and gratitude. I sound like a motivational
speaker. That's okay. It sounds like, is this?
Stop. Hey, that's Renee Brown, move over.
We're going to use that in our promo. That's going to be Kathy Valentine, your new guru.
Motivational speaker. Is this, I guess it sounds, it reminds me, I mean, is this something that you learned through your classes at AA when you did go?
It's just life and being willing to, I mean, sobriety is this foundation for everything for me. Sobriety is why I have a daughter, why I'm alive, why I pay my bills, why I am not sick, and why I don't look like, you know, I've been dragged behind a truck for 20 years. It's like, sobriety is everything for me. But yeah, you know, I'm not a religious person, so I had to start finding my spirituality and the ways that worked for me. And just being my age and being open and receptive to growing and changing and evolving.
It's funny because it's kind of like your song Can't Stop the World. Can you talk a little bit about, we haven't talked about any Go-Go's music at all, but I guess that was the first song you wrote with Carla.
My song. I wrote it before Carla.
Oh, before. Okay. Well, tell me a little bit about Can't Stop the World. Where were you at the time?
I had LA. I'd moved to LA to make it. I moved with my best friend that was in my band, the third band member, Carla. She was a lot more responsible, a few years older. So she wasn't moving from Austin to LA until she had her job lined up. Whereas me and my young friend, Marilyn, we just jumped in the Delta 88 and sped across the desert. And she promptly moved into a nice apartment with a friend and had a fake ID. And me, after going out to clubs for years in Austin, was in a city where you had to be 21 and I didn't have an ID. So I'm abandoned and I'm alone and I know nobody and I have no money. And I'm pretty damn bitter and unhappy in general. And yet, this is where I discover songwriting. And I had written a few songs. I'd been playing guitar since I was 14 or 15. And I'd written a few songs, but that wasn't where I had been put it. I was kind of more concerned with being a great guitar player. So I started writing songs and the first song I wrote in LA was Can't Stop the World. And it really melded my external situation with what I was feeling inside. And in my book, I write, that's where I really became a true musician, not because I could play the scales up and down the neck 20 miles an hour, but because I was able to make a musical expression out of what I was feeling and filter my external circumstances through music. So once I did that, I was off and running, and writing songs has been my go-to for many years. It's quite a therapy. But Can't Stop the World ended up, not only did my band The Textones do it, but the Go-Go's put it on the first album, which was wonderful for me because I was the last member to join, and that album easily could have not had any songs by me. Another song right after that I wrote, We Don't Get Along, which was my very first cover song. A wonderful artist named Phil Seymour cut it. Mm-hmm. And Phil Seymour was a great singer. He sang backup with Tom Petty. He'd been in the Dwight Twilley band. People that know anything about some of the 70s and 80s music might recognize Phil and some of his songs. So I got my first cover song. And then on the Go-Go's second album, then the other song I wrote in those early days before being a go-go was Vacation. And Vacation was the song that the Textones also recorded, and a song that I showed Charlotte pretty soon after I joined the band. And she said, oh, this is a good go-go song. Let's make the chorus a little bit more fleshed out. So we sat down and kind of reworked it and rewrote it. Not rewrote the song, but added a chorus to it. And so, yeah, there you have it.
Okay, we're going to stop this right now. We will be back shortly. We are still talking with Kathy Valentine of the Go-Go's.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment of Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast and our conversation with Kathy Valentine.
Charlotte was she the arranger, or did she have the best ideas of musically how to flesh out a go-go song, how to make a song a go-go song?
No, I think that was everybody.
Okay.
Did that. Everybody had ideas for that, but just I'm bringing her a song that we didn't write together. And I'm saying, you know, I'm the newest band member. And I'm saying, do you think this would be good for the Go-Go's? And she's saying, yeah, but maybe just in her version. But that didn't mean all along down the line.
Right. Okay.
That's what she did. Just in that situation, when I showed it to her, that was her opinion of what the song needed. And so I think we have a really great chorus, but I still like the original too. It's got its own little attitude.
Do you play with the Textones, or what's your relationship with Carla and the band? And you see,
we're friends. I'm pretty much friends with everybody that I've ever known. so we're friends, and the original Vacation just got licensed to a TV show. I forget the name of the show, but that's kind of cool. So even after all these years, we all got paid for the original version of Vacation. The second Vacation that I wrote with Charlotte, that where we added a chorus, is kind of what's known as a derivative work, because it took an existing song and altered it. So there's two versions, and she's kept the Textones going for decades, you know. So, and they have their own little niche that they've carved out. So yeah, I'm friends with them. I rehooked up with Marilyn from the Violators, my first punk rock band, through Facebook, and we hadn't talked for decades. And it's pretty amazing to have these long ago relationships that, because of the internet and social media, can resurface.
Yeah. That's funny. When you mentioned reconnecting with her, I assumed it was through social media, but you didn't. I don't think you specifically said it. I was going to say it had to be Facebook.
Yeah, I was stunned. I thought she had died. That was the rumor. So I was stunned. I'm like, you don't want to say I thought you died, but that's what I was thinking. Oh, man.
There is something about people who knew you when.
Yeah, it's funny. And you know, I've been back in LA for 13 years, but LA, I lived for 27 years. And those are the years where, you know, I'm in my 20s, I'm in my 30s, part of my 40s. And those are the kind of friendships that are pretty solid, you know, as a mom in Austin with a teenager, it's not like I'm making a lot of other mom friends, you know. It's not like we're at the playgroup, you know, hanging out. So
did you do that though when she was little?
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. But she'll be going to college next year, and I'll probably go wherever she goes. I mean, not to be like breathing down her neck, but I want to be in the same city as my daughter. There's only the two of us.
She's not going to UT? Is that?
No, she wants to go to UCLA. She wants to go to UCLA. Her dad is in UCLA. Her dad's in LA, and that'd be fine with me. I would be happy to go back to LA. Not forever, but for a year, just in that transition period. So, and now that I'm a writer, I can write anywhere. And I'm a musician, I can do music anywhere. So I've always felt very free and flexible about where I call home, you know?
Yeah. Well, you picked some good city. Well, I guess you didn't choose Austin if you were born there, but good music cities.
Yeah.
The cover photo, which I love, the cover of All I Ever Wanted. Did Catherine Sebastian take that photo?
Yes. Hopefully. I'm sure she's credited on there. Yeah, that I think I write in the book, like, she did photos and I looked at them, and it was like the first time in my entire life that I thought, oh, I'm pretty. Like, it was so wild. And I was 20 years old in that photo. And at first I thought, well, is this cheating to like put a young, and then my publisher, the person I was dealing with, the marketing person, was like, you know, the book is about this period of your life. You know, it's not about you now. It almost would be weird to have a picture of you now when you're writing about an earlier period. And I love how it's like looking back. So it's like I'm looking back on my life. And it was awesome to reconnect with Catherine Sebastian. We had been in touch over the years, but to actually get to work together, and she sent me photos that I had no idea. And I had a great time looking, just seeing how documented my life was back then by her. She's a great photographer, and I love the book. I think it's beautiful. You know, if I didn't know me and I was in a bookstore, hopefully one day we'll all be in bookstores again, and I walked by that book, I know I would pick it up. I know I would.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's beautiful, and the cover photo is perfect. I think it's very fitting of the book.
You're still close with all your friends. What have the reviews been, or what has been the reaction? Any surprises from people that you're close to?
Well, most people want to know what the other Go-Go's think, and everyone likes it and is either expressed, oh my God, I didn't know all this stuff, or I'm so proud of you, or you did such a great job. So I've gotten great feedback from the band. A lot of Go-Go's fans have told me that they got it because they were curious about that part, but were surprised to find how much they enjoyed reading about my journey to that and afterwards, I really didn't feel like the success of the Go-Go's and achieving that would have the meaning it did if it didn't have the context. If you didn't read and understand where I was coming from, there's no way my reader would understand how profoundly important it was to me and how devastating it was to lose it when I had finally found a way to belong and to support myself and take care of myself and make it in a band. But I have seen online a few grumblings from people going, why does she talk about this so much? Why does she talk about her mom? Why did she stop at 1990? So to those people, I would just say, you know, I never set out to write the Go-Go's history. You know, my job is not to document everything the Go-Go's did. And my job, the way I saw it, was to get on the map as a writer to do a great job so that people saw that I'm a writer. She can do this. She can do this well. I like her voice. I want to read more. I want more. That was my job. And so that's what I set out to do. Very few people have complained about that. A few people have said, why does it stop at 1990? And any writer will tell you, I mean, I wanted to adhere to the conventions of good writing. When I write a song, I'm not writing an experimental art piece. I'm writing something that you are going to hear and remember and be hooky. And it's going to have a verse and a chorus and a bridge. And that's what I'm aiming to do. So when I wanted to write a book, I wanted the arc. I wanted my protagonist, me, to be faced with obstacles that she overcame and then ended up a changed person. That was the arc. I thought I had a perfect arc. And I loved that it was the 70s in Austin, the 80s in LA, great eras, a lot going on in the world that I consistently touch on my journey and how the parallel of what's happening in the world and the context for what's happening. You know, the Go-Go's success was against a backdrop of Ronald Reagan and the country changing enormously and AIDS happening and being ignored by the government. And, you know, these were profound things that shaped culture and had an effect on everybody, not only growing up, but on the Go-Go's. So I had a very clear vision of what I wanted to do. And what I did not want to do was document everything that the Go-Go's have done.
I couldn't stop comparing myself to my old bandmates. They had success. I felt like a sucker. Still had some rock and roll composure. I'm a rock chick. That's a sorry consolation prize.
Deposits, lost that go-go cash.
Who would I ask for help?
Nobody.
Mom won the kid lottery. Dad's not so fatherly. You better take care of yourself.
I was my own cheerleader.
So there was that feedback, and I've gotten a lot of feedback of people just saying, oh my God, it's so honest and so raw. But that's, to me, that's what a memoir is.
That's what I want. Yeah, that's what you want to hear.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. And you don't make yourself come out. You have to be unflinching looking at yourself and say, this is what I did wrong. And this is where I screwed up. And this is, the way I behaved was shameful. You got to be willing to do that, or you have no credibility as a writer. And I'm someone that has taken creative writing classes. I've been a on and off college student long enough that I'm two classes away from getting an English bachelor's degree. So nice. I know, and I'm a 4.0, not to brag, but I'm an A student. So I know what the elements of writing are. Plus, I've read every great book ever written. So that was my plan, not to do, and I knew I would fall short. In case this sounds like I think I'm the greatest writer, I knew I would fall short, but I knew what I was shooting for.
And how did your mom receive the book?
She said it was really hard for her. She said it was really hard. And yet she signed off on everything. I told her, like, do you remember when this happened? For your listeners, my mom, she got high with me. She had an affair with a teenage guy that was a friend of mine. She never punished me, never gave me any consequences for anything I did that was crazy or wild, whether it was hitchhiking around or getting picked up by the police for being passed out on the side of the road. My mom never had one retribution for me. So I was pretty much fending for myself. At the same time, she supported me in everything I wanted to do. I mean, anything and everything I wanted to do, she was there for me. She loved me more than anything, but she just wasn't equipped for parenting. That was not her deal. She was really going against her nature. But when you love someone, and yet it's not in your nature to be a parent, all you're left with is doing the best you can. So it was more important to her that I write the truth and that I write what happened than it was for her to look like this exemplary mom. That was more important to her. And people have said nasty things. I've heard people say, oh, you know, your mom was terrible. She was a horrible person. And that is not how I portrayed her. I portrayed her with love, gratitude, and a lot of credit for my strength and resilience. But people are going to take away what they take away. And, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you had such a traumatic childhood. And I'm just like looking at the big picture of childhoods and going, I wasn't sexually abused. I was not thrown in a closet and beaten with a stick. I wasn't shuffled from horrible foster care to, you know, that to me, there's so many, and not to reduce or dismiss my hardships, but there's a lot worse things that kids go through and survive and triumph over.
I thought it was remarkable because I felt that during the whole, really up until you wrote about her losing the condo in Austin, you really wrote about her matter-of-factly, and I appreciated that, you know, because we can draw our own judgments if we want to as the reader, but yes. I thought that was really fair.
Yeah, and I've had some people say, your mom is like the hero of the story. So people really are taking their own takeaway from it. And, and I'm glad because, you know, just as I was talking about the elements to writing a story, a very typical element is to have a villain or an antagonist. And in my case, it was myself. I was both the protagonist and the antagonist. And I did not want my mom to be the villain. You know, I did not want to demonize her. I wanted to say what happened. At the same time, I ended up very capable and resilient and strong because of that. I was lucky. A lot of the things that could have gone wrong didn't. You know, people react in different ways. Sadly, you know, sometimes people go in a more destructive. I mean, I was destructive in my own way, but it wasn't. It was, you know, a lot of stuff. I think my dad not being there was just as much a part of my self-destructiveness as was my mom not parenting me.
In the introduction, you also say to your mom that you are so much stronger and braver than you know. What is it that you saw in her that she didn't see in herself?
I saw her as fearless. She seemed fearless to me. She seemed, I mean, what it was in reality, it was reckless and irresponsible. But she pretty much did what she wanted her way, and the rules didn't apply to her. Now, sometimes that's a really bad thing. It still is. You know, mom, if you get a ticket, you have to pay it. The rules do apply to you. If you run up your credit card, you got to pay the bill. The rules apply. But in other ways, it was a good thing to think the rules didn't apply to me. I don't have to go to college right away. Why can't I get my degree when I'm 61? You know, why do I have to do it now? Why can't I go chase my dream and want to be in a band? So in a lot of ways, thinking that the rules didn't necessarily have to apply were a good thing for me. But I just took it. I had the sense to put some boundaries in there, whereas I don't know if my mom did, you know. She's just kind of across the board. I do what I want.
Yeah. Does she now? Has she learned to live within the rules? No.
Same person. I love her dearly. I love her dearly. The book really opened my heart to her. I have had a lot of resentment over the years, a lot of resentment. Not so much about how I was raised, but that she just didn't look ahead. She didn't take care of business. She didn't set up retirement. I just kind of started taking on the role of the caretaker. You know, from the minute I was successful, my driving thing was, you know, I'm going to get my mom a condo and I'm going to give her this money every month so she can go back to school and she can get her master. And, you know, I had all these plans for my mom, like how she was going to be happy, how she was going to be successful, how she was going to. And it's like a hard thing to swallow. You know, I think probably parents go through it with their kids. You know, you're like, I'm going to give you the best education and I'm going to give you this. And then sometimes the kid just goes off. And so it was a very reversed thing where I was and am the parent. And yet she's very independent and doesn't want a parent. So it's a dance. And I have to do what's, you know, I'm a real mom to a real child. And at the same time, I'm not going to do anything to make an 83-year-old person's life unpleasant. You know, it's lonely and scary being 83. My mom she's on her own. She's very independent, but I'm not going to throw her out on the street and go figure it out. You know, I'm going to make sure she has everything she needs.
She must have done something right when you think about that, no matter what, if she instilled that in you somehow, she did right.
I don't know. I mean, some people are fairly loyal, and, you know, and maybe it's just ingrained in me that I'm, that's my job.
Wherever it came from.
You know.
What is the relationship between your daughter and your mom?
My mom adores her granddaughter, and largely because she probably doesn't feel judged and criticized, because I do not. My face like shows everyone laughs and goes, whatever you're thinking is so evident on your face. So I can be like this. And I think with me, she feels judged and criticized a lot, and she doesn't get that. So she can love my daughter completely and not feel judged, which is not nice. And we laugh. Me and my daughter laugh at her quirks. She's a very quirky woman, but she's very adorable in a way. My friends all adore her. They just love her. So writing the book really opened my heart to her, which has been a wonderful byproduct, because that's what you want. You do not want to be 60 years old resenting your 80 something year old parents. That's just not where you want to be, you know.
Your dad, the story about your dad, and I am sorry, we kind of glossed over it before, but the way you reconnected with him, I also found, you know, very heartwarming and very forgiving of you, because you could have easily carried that to, you know, anger and resentment. I mean, it makes us feel, the reader feel that, well, they might have, oh, wow, you're a really good person.
Well, and one beautiful thing was, you know, I really felt like I didn't matter to my dad. You know, from the time I was a little girl, I felt like if I mattered, he would come visit more. He wouldn't. Yeah. I mean, he married and raised his wife's two daughters, and I felt like they were a family and that I didn't matter. They were the ones that mattered to him. And yet, when he died, and I went to clean out his place with my stepsister, I found a folder, and it had every letter I'd ever written him from the time I was a little girl. It had clippings about the Go-Go's. And I mean, it was just like, it was this realization. Of course, I realized it in our talks at the end of his life, because he was lucid and had his wits about him to his last breath. So we had many, many talks, but that was a very tangible thing that I could look at and go, I mattered all along. I mattered the entire time. He just didn't express it or didn't know how to express it. Or maybe his wife didn't want him to, you know. So it's bittersweet, but very, it was kind of neat to be, at the time I was 59, and to go, you were wrong. All this time you thought you didn't matter, and you did. He had saved everything.
Well, it's not too late to have that realization. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's
a nice closure. That's crazy.
Here I am again. Wah, wah.
No,
no, right. It's a happy to me. Yeah. That's happy.
Yeah. For some reason I thought y'all's podcast was more like, I don't know, kind of like lighthearted and stuff. Well,
It usually is.
It is.
So here Kathy Valentine comes along and we're like just plumbing the depths of everything. So anyway, I'm sorry if I pulled y'all into that story too much, but at the same time, I'm not a very superficial small talk type person.
It's exactly what we wanted. This is
kind of like to get right into the real stuff. I don't want to talk about the weather, you know.
No, and I think our listeners, you know, will want to hear the stories also. Yes, we're uplifting, I guess, by nature, because 80s music, for the most part, I guess, is uplifting.
Yes.
Hell, this is what I wanted to hear. This is the story I want.
Oh, good. And hopefully it's not a down. I think it is uplifting, you know. But yeah, it's funny. I had to do an 80s guest VJ spot for Sirius for 80s on 8. And it just has been airing, and I've been getting so many people saying how much they love the playlist and stuff. And I had fun going back and just, because sometimes I'll make up a playlist, but it's just all over. I don't focus specifically on one era. So I had a really good time doing that. And people have told me that read the book, because music is with me every step of the way. Even before I'm a musician, music is what is saving me, like so many teenagers, you know, so many of us. Mm-hmm. Music was was proof that there was a better world out there awaiting me than what was in my painful surroundings. And music soothed me and made me just exhilarated and expressed how I felt. So I talk a lot about music from the very beginning of the book. And so many people have told me that when I would mention something, whether it was, you know, Maggie May or Sunshine of Your Love or, you know, In the Summertime, they go back and listen to that. Sometimes I feel like I should make not only the playlist that I listened to that took me back to each age, but what I write about. I think that could be a cool one too, because people have told me they really like doing that. You know, I write about Exile on Main Street and Ziggy Stardust and, oh, just so much music was there.
I love that you had given up smoking, but you took it up again because you wanted an introduction to Keith Richards. That was a great story.
my little brain was churning. I'm like, what do I say? What do I say? What do I say to Keith? And then I'm like, can I have a smoke? Yeah.
Is that still in your will, though, that he gets the 62 Stratocaster?
No. And my will was like me writing. I thought that's all I needed was to write it out. My will, my guitar to Keith. I mean, to me, that was a will. So that's what I told him.
You commented also about meeting Keith Richards, about speaking to, you know, some of the people that you worshipped or idolized, but you admired. Mm-hmm. And about how they're, you know, they're just people. You put it in some other more articulate way. How they're just people. So if you're going to converse with them, you want it to be organic.
Yeah, it's like, and I don't take anything. I mean, I've had a lot of people come up to me and all they say is like, my first concert was this, or I was at Wolf Trap in Vienna, or I was here. And that's all they can think to say to me. And I would never say that's not okay. That's fine. Say whatever you want. I like people. I like meeting people. But for me, if I met somebody, I want to like a little bit more of an exchange. I want it to be real, like something like an actual conversation. So, at the same time, you don't want to like, I mean, go into too much detail and have them like be running away from you. But yeah, I think people are just, they're just people. And, you know, why limit the conversation to just being a fan, you know, for me.
That's why I'm glad we had the book to discuss, because otherwise I would have just sat here. I promised Dave I wouldn't get all fangirl, but I am going to tell you that your songs are some of my favorite Go-Go songs.
Oh, thank you. I love hearing that. You know, I was in a band with two very great really good songwriters in Jane and Charlotte. And I learned a lot about writing songs from them. But and I think equally from, you know, I think they got stuff from me, too. But so it's always nice to hear that because, you know, we had a lot of great songs. So any songwriter likes hearing that. So thank you.
And my fanboy thing is first time I saw the Go-Go's was the Sirius Barbecue Tour when you opened for Bowie. That was Madness, Go-Go's and Bowie. And that was that was a good intro. That was like my first that was like my first big concert where it was just my friends. I didn't have so it was it was spectacular.
I bet. Did you read the when I wrote about that?
Oh yeah.
Did you get to that chapter?
Oh yeah. I finished this whole thing this week.
That concert was a big deal because it had come after 8 months of a lot of problems, and you know I was scared to death that the band was going to end. You know, and then you get this opportunity falls in your lap to open for David Bowie at Anaheim Stadium and kill it. So it was a very triumphant moment. And I loved writing about that. And I even found, you know how I describe how we start the set? Mm-hmm. You might not remember, but I describe in minute detail how that, because I found a cassette of it. Mm-hmm. I found a cassette of us doing that show. Otherwise, I wouldn't have remembered that how we, because we don't usually start with a cappella, This Town, mm-hmm. where it's just a vocal going, this town, this town. So yeah. I had the tape and I was like, oh my God, we did that song so uniquely for that one show. And it was perfect because then I could write about it.
Yeah, that was great. And I also,
but the feelings of remembering about it with what I had heard and just, it was perfect.
It's also nice to have YouTube because you were talking about the final show in Rio when the band's doing Head Over Heels. You can kind of see kind of what you were describing, but mm-hmm. you were very, you were loving playing the guitar during in this. I'm sure you've pulled it up before, but just watching you, yeah. it looks like everyone else is just kind of holding it together. And you are so thrilled to be playing the guitar and you are all over the stage.
So funny. I'm all over the place. I'm just like, in my mind, yes, you're going on. It's a new chapter. Because what I wanted was, I wanted a band that just, you know, went on and on, like the Stones, like U2, like, you know, so many bands. It just, album after, maybe this one's a dud, so what? Then they come back with this great album. It's like, I just thought it would go on and on and on and on. So to me, it was just a new chapter. It was a drag that Jane left. I hated that she left, but the idea of it being over was not something I could comprehend. I was in denial that it was ever going to be over. So to be playing the biggest show we'd ever done, and I moved over to the guitar and we found a good bass player and it's all happening. And I just nothing pierced that denial. I mean, clearly you look at that tape, that video, and it's not the Go-Go's at their peak, but it's hilarious because there's me like, oh, yes, it is. <You know? laughs> It is funny.
But life should always be lived that way, right? You should always, I mean, like, this is it.
There's a thin line. I mean, it's like, you can be like a puppy dog and get up every morning like with your tail wagging, thinking it's going to be the best day of your life. And then you can be in denial that everything's falling apart and be a jerk because you're just refusing to acknowledge anyone else's pain. So yeah, there's a line there that we figure out eventually.
We've taken up an hour and a half of your time. This is such a great journey that you took us on through this book. I loved it so much. And I recommend Wanted, a rock and roll memoir by Kathy Valentine. So thrilling to talk to you. You know, we've watched you for so long and you have no idea how much we were screaming when we heard that we're going to get to talk to you.
Well, I have to say I've done a lot of interviews and I really enjoyed talking to you both too. So there's something that we all clicked really well and it was nice for me too. So thank you for that.
Oh my God, that was so much fun. Can you believe we just talked to Kathy Valentine?
Has the whole world lost its head yet?
Would you like to take that back, Holly?
No, the whole world was losing. Has the whole world lost its head because we got to talk to Kathy Valentine?
I agree. No, I love your pun. It's good.
We were so lucky to be able to talk to Kathy Valentine about her book, All I Ever Wanted.
A rock and roll memoir. And indeed it was, and quite a journey. So we highly recommend picking up this book. It was.
You will not be able to put it down.
We didn't. We literally, I mean, we did because we had to eat and sleep, but we got through it really quick, and it's a wonderful read, and it's honest, and as I'm sure you got from listening to this podcast, she is genuine and the real deal. So thank you so much to Kathy Valentine, and until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.